WBRU-FM is born, 1966 to 1976.
Remember how we listened to the radio, and I said that's the place to be. And how I got the job as an FM jock the day you married me. It was two kids and I was into AM rock, but I just had to run.
Not too many people really thought through what it was going to be like to have students running an over-the-air commercial radio station, I don't think. But you have to remember, no one had FM radios. So it was sort of like hard HD radio is now. It was a concept, but hadn't really flown.
Playing all the hits for you, wherever you may be.
On February 21st, 1966, WBRU's potential audience grew from a few thousand on-campus students and faculty to 1.4 million Southern New Englanders. But in spite of its superior stereo sound, many FM stations simulcast their AM programming. Brown University professor of American civilization Susan Smulyan explains.
When the FM band opens up, all of a sudden there's other possibilities. But the technology comes in and fits and starts. And so for a while, there are very few radios that actually get FM. So there are new possibilities for stations, but there's no one knows if anyone's listening because they're not selling many FM radios. They're hard to find. So there's room on the FM dial and on these FM stations for experimentation because advertisers aren't interested. They're like, why should we do that? You know, they said, we don't even know if there are any listeners.
Many students got their inspiration for FM radio working at local stations. Don Burns, 69, worked at WICE, the local top 40 station.
But back in 1965, top 40 radio was massive. But that's why, you know, listening sessions all night, people would go to somebody else's room and listen to WLS or WCFL out of Chicago, WABC out of New York. They just came booming in at night because the AM signal bounces off the ionosphere, I guess it is.
1966 proved to be an important year for FM throughout the country, when the FCC ruled that radio stations could not simulcast more than 50% of their AM content. Suddenly forced to generate original programming, FM stations became an uninhibited space for experimentation that could not exist on commercial AM. The radio world changed rapidly in the late 1960s, and WBRU staffers were in a unique position to take advantage of it. But WBRU was in debt to Brown University from the very beginning, and this fact loomed over early programming. Here's Stu Aronson, class of 66.
Now, of course, it signed on originally as the radio voice of Brown University, which was pretty sad. We used to do some really awful programs, you know, provided by the university, or we did some very bad music. We did a lot of very bad stuff that first year. There were programs like From College Hill with Professor Barry Marks of the English department. Oh, it was, you know, commentary about what was going on the Hill. And Barry is a wonderful guy, but even he knew how bad the program was.
Fred Brack, class of 66, was WBRU-FM's first program director.
We were very much under the eyes of the Brown University Corporation, and they were very concerned about the image that Brown University would present. And although I was not in on any of the discussions, a decision was made that it would not be appropriate to play rock and roll music on the new station. They liked the idea of continuing with the folk music, which I think was a Saturday or Sunday show, and some classical music, and they wanted us to do some public affairs and news. But the bass type of music was the music that we still at that time classified as big band music.
The stereo sounds of the modern big bands, available in Providence at 95.5 and Music 67.
Playing rock and roll on FM was really something that only a couple of stations nationwide were doing at the time.
Don Burns.
and there was a conservatism, there was a conservative element at WBRU, which was very scared that they had would have just spent a whole lot of years and a whole lot of effort and a whole lot of money to get an FM license and didn't want to piss it down the toilet with a format that wasn't tried and true on FM.
From the newest albums of the nation's most popular entertainers comes the music for WBRU's Music 67.
Petula Clark, for example.
Fred Bragg.
We used to play her music because we thought it could be generally appreciated by everybody, but she weren't going to be playing the Rolling Stones or the Beatles. So we were right on the cusp in 66.
Jerry Hubany, class of 1967.
Of FM starting to play something other than classical music and information and what I used to call elevator music. And some of us who were working in radio at rock stations wanted to do rock and roll. And some of us thought that was too big a risk to do, that the university wouldn't let us do that. So there was a compromise, and we came up with something, I think, called Music 66, which was horrible, horrible elevator music. And I think it was there until about 69.
Music for the FM generation. The sound of today. Music 67. That's the music policy of WBRU-FM. A sound that's alive and modern. The sound of life and spirit. Not just a background music service, but music that lives, swings, entertains, and excites.
Music selection on AM, meanwhile, remained a mix of top 40 and freeform.
Given the type of music that we played, there was probably less interest in the FM station music than there was in the AM station music by the population of the students as a whole.
Debbie Rich grew up in Rhode Island, and she's been listening to WBRU-FM since the 60s. She remembers the first time she heard WBRU. As a kid, she was a fan of the Top 40 AM radio station, WICE, where Don Burns was working part-time when he wasn't at Brew.
Back at my house, my mom was also listening to radio, and there was another station that she was listening to. And it was, you know, the regular old elevator music, just plain old stuff that a parent of that time would be listening to. And as I was listening to it one day with her in the kitchen, I hear a familiar voice, and it's Don Burns. So I get the phone book, and I look up, and I call him at WBRU. And he says, "What are you listening to this stuff for?"
All the big names and popular music are featured on WBRU. Count Basie, Frank Sinatra, Nancy Wilson, Andy Williams, the Ray Charles Singers, and many other established performers. But WBRU-FM goes further with a modern, hip, young sound.
By the late 1960s, many students who entered college in a jacket and tie left with a tie-dye t-shirt and a ponytail. The higher sound quality of stereo FM radio, which initially drew aficionados of classical and big band music, caught on with young fans of new psychedelic progressive rock coming out of stations in New York and San Francisco. Here is Brown professor Susan Smolyan, author of Selling Radio, The Commercialization of American Broadcasting, 1920 to 1934.
At about the same time that the music industry switches from 45s to albums, these FM stations find these albums and they can play the whole thing because there's no... But he's stopping them. There are no commercials, basically, so they don't have anything they have to put on instead. And the audience grows because it's much more interesting than what's on Top 40. And so FM takes off.
By the winter of 66, spring of 67, there was a growing feeling that we should be playing rock and roll on FM.
Don Burns.
It all boiled down to the executive board elections in the spring of 1967, where I said, "Okay, let's do rock and roll." And Fred Brack, who I was running against, said, no, we need to continue where we're what we're doing. And by a very small margin, I was elected program director, and we began the change immediately.
Here's Jerry Hubany again.
Part of the reason it didn't go on, Rock didn't go on to begin with, was fear of the university. But in fairness, another part of it is there were station members who didn't think that that would be appropriate. From the beginning, we had to make money because we all knew we had to be self-sustaining. And those of us at the time involved in radio thought the best way to do that was going to be with rock and roll.
Don Burns was elected the next programming director, and he premiered rock on WBRU-FM in the after-hours shifts.
The sound is stereo rock, 19 hours a day, on WBRU-FM in Providence.
The station started programming progressive rock in the evenings, then in the afternoons, and then by 1969, the format completely switched over.
This must be the place. 1 minute after 11, at Jerry Stevens here. We got rid of Don Burns for a minute or two, so I can sneak in another one of my favorites. Don keeps coming up with this new stuff that I've never heard of, like The Who, and the organ grinders, and the assistant product manager, and everything else. But I go way back into the 50s. There's a song out on the new Beatles album that I guess we've all been exposed to an awful lot by now, just in the week or two that it's been out. But I happen to really like it.
Here's listener Debbie Rich again.
FM was very new. I mean, I had a transistor radio. I don't even think it went from AM to FM. I think it was just an AM transistor radio, and I got WICE, and I was happy. And that was it. But once FM started, and once I knew it was there, I worked in a bakery, my family's bakery after school, and we had an AM-FM radio there, and the only station that was on in the bakery when I was working was BRU. And I listened to this unbelievable music that was not, I mean, it was non-existent on the AM dial at the time. BRU was playing everything and you know, songs of alternatives of the time that were really not that far out of the mainstream or the top 40, but they were just a little too long or they were just a little too controversial for the time. And here, anything goes.
11 past 11. 11:11. We used to call that a double reverse natural way back in the old days, but I won't insult your intelligence by saying that. Hey, I got a thought for you. And then we're going to have to split for a couple commercials and come right back with something that I really like. I hope you, if you don't, you know, that's tough. 863-2892 is the number, but I'm warning you, we're rejecting about 9 out of 10 requests. So don't feel badly if you don't hear your request. Don and I are being very picky tonight, but I'll leave you with this thought immediately prior to commercial time. We've all had headaches, right? I had a wicked one today, and suddenly it disappeared. Where'd it go? Who has it now?
You know, you wanted to be as hip as possible. You didn't want to be pseudo-hip. You didn't want to try too hard, although I'm sure most of us did. But back in the 60s, we heard some pretty affected people who were actually quite good. People on WNEW in New York and BCN, WBCN in Boston. Once we got the format on the air and realized that we could sell it, make enough money to run the radio station, then the first thing we did was hire a professional salesperson to go out and do it full time. And that professional salesperson was Stu Aronson.
I was the person at BRU in the first years who suggested that one of the things we had to consider was making money. That we signed the station on with Reveille Rock one morning, and that, you know, it's been a rock station ever since. There were faculty members clearly appalled by this. They'd call up and you'd say to them, well, you know, if you want to pay the bills, we'll play anything you want.
Here's Lawrence Moss, class of 73.
You know, the station was actually in debt, I think, when I first got there. We were just, and the, it was a source of concern to the university, but that all turned around during my years when we were lucky enough to be riding such a wave of advertising revenue. And having so little expenses, not having to pay any staff, and having so much money suddenly coming in, there was a lot of disposable income in the station in those years.
You know, it was the 60s, you know, it was hippie time.
John Peck, class of 64.
And the audience that was looking for a station like that loved it. It was the alternative to top 40 programming.
It was a very political time. The Vietnam War was still on. The end of my first year at Brown, President Nixon determined to invade Cambodia. So there were explosive protests all over the country. Many campuses, including most of the Ivy League campuses, shut down without finishing their semesters, with basically students and faculty both going on strike. Sales Hall became People's Hall, and WBRU became Radio Free Rhode Island.
For 2 weeks, Radio Free Rhode Island aired news and documentaries about the war while covering the reaction stateside.
You know, probably a lot of us were inspired by the tradition of the Pacifica radio stations. You know, a lot of that kind of programming, I think we tried to recreate on the news side. But we had plenty of people who were, you know, more traditional and just wanted to be straight, well-modulated broadcast journalists.
Brew FM built on the legacy of serious news programming that had started at Brew AM.
You've been listening to a special report on WBRU. This is Mark Jordan inviting you to tune in again tomorrow night at 6:30 for complete news coverage on the Evening Report.
Here's Ben Weiser, class of 76, who's now a reporter for the New York Times.
You know, you'd listen and you could get a 5-minute report instead of a 30-second report that you might get on the local evening news on television. It was not an NPR station, but much of the news coverage was sort of in the style of what we know of NPR today, which was thoughtful, drawn out interviews, mini documentaries. There were very strict rules that required stations to devote a fair amount of time to the public interest and the local public interest, and there was a real sense of responsibility.
For his continued war on poverty, Mr. Johnson will be lucky to get as much as before, although he asked for more, and he knows he won't get his civil rights bill, which was turned down by the 89th Congress.
This was in 1972, of course, was a hugely divisive time in America, and a real sense of excitement in covering the news, and also a real sense that, you know, this station as an alternative station could do things that the commercial news media was not doing. There was a lot of income coming in, and because nobody at the station was being paid, a lot of the money could go toward building up a news department. So I remember the news department spending a lot of time developing and devoting resources to covering political conventions, not just obviously in New England, but wherever they were being held, the Democratic and Republican conventions, regularly covering City Hall and the state capitol in Providence. Brew at the time prided itself on the fact that it did not cover campus news. People who worked at Brew News were out covering local news primarily in Rhode Island, and it was a great opportunity to learn journalism.
By the early 1970s, BRU News had a half-hour newscast at 6 p.m., followed by a half-hour public affairs program. At 10 p.m., music programming made way for a 15-minute newscast.
There was a sense of comfort that the news could you know, amicably live with the music as part of what the station was offering. You know, I don't believe that the news is what drove listeners to WBRU, but I think the news gave them something very important in what they listened to.
Don Burns says music programmers developed a friendly rivalry with the news department.
It was not unusual for people to do everything that you've heard about in radio legends that are mostly true. Set news copy on fire while the newsman was reading it. Chuck a moon at the window, actually pressed ham at the window while the person was reading the news. I've even heard stories of people taking a dump in the wastebasket next to the news guy while he was doing the news. Yeah. I mean, because news was so serious, and we in programming were not. You know, we were a bunch of assholes. So we tried to break up the news people, and in some cases it worked, and if it didn't work, we'd pat them on the back and say, you're really professional, congratulations.
In 1975, while covering a story at a state correctional institution, student Mark Rosati caught wind of an internal report that described abuse at the Patrick O'Rourke Children's Center for Displaced Children in Providence. Weiser and Rosati took a leave of absence from WBRU and both dropped a course to investigate. 35 hours of tape and 400 pages of written notes resulted in an hour-long documentary titled Brutality in the Children's Center.
Once again, James Cuddy, social worker, here describing the conditions in that school.
One day, told him of how he had to sneak to school and sneak from his cottage to school and sneak from his cottage from the school back to his cottage because of, you know, just the assaults and intimidation of the older adolescents. You know, as a matter of fact, I one afternoon in the spring, I was pulling in, you know, I was coming back from lunch, and this was about 1 o'clock, and there he was hiding behind the car, and I said, "Patrick, what are you doing?" And he says, "Oh, I'm going to school."
The shocking report aired during Brew's primetime news hour on December 8, 1975. Other local and national media picked up on the story. The reporter's dedication earned 3 awards for the station, including the American Bar Association's prestigious Silver Gavel Award. Most importantly, the documentary reached the ears of federal authorities and led to improvements at the center.
We learned, certainly as students, that journalism is a great way to have impact and create change, and sometimes it's for the better.
This was just one of the many stories that won awards and made an impact during that era. In this progressive political decade, WBRU's election coverage became the most comprehensive of all state media outlets, except for the Providence Journal, according to news director Bob Goodman, class of 78. It was this kind of experience that launched the careers of Ralph Begleiter, today a correspondent for CNN, and Andy Fisher, president of Cox Programming.
Fashion a lopsided majority here. He can look forward to being a senator for another 6 years. That's what's happening in the South. Now back to Ralph Begleiter at Election Central.
Thank you very much, Bob. I know we're looking at the congressional races pretty heavily this evening, but we're also looking at the races for governor.
Reporters followed races throughout New England during the months leading up to the election. They drove WBRU's Chevrolet, acquired from a trade with local car dealer Ed Butler, and called their reports in from payphones. Then, on the first Tuesday in November, WBRU became Southern New England's election headquarters.
The election coverage was very sophisticated. At least 1 year it was done in the Fonce House theater space, which was a huge cavernous room in Fonce House. And we set up tables with anchors covering various parts, some covering local, some covering regional, and then 2 major anchors, and then had dozens and perhaps up to 50, 60, 70 people spanning across New England covering various races. And at the time, people were calling in from payphones. I don't think anyone had cell phones at the time. And it was complicated, and there were producers. It was one of the most sophisticated and amazing operations I've ever seen. And I saw it both as a reporter out in the field in the first election and as an anchor towards the end. And this was on FM primetime, 4 or 5 hours straight, on the air live coverage. We were modeling it after what we saw on network TV news.
We did obviously get out into the community, and we're trying hard to build up a community listenership. And we had a pretty powerful signal, and felt the responsibility for elections coverage.
Penny Dixon Gum, class of 72. Recalls working behind the scenes in the tech department to make such extensive coverage possible.
We built a lot of stuff from scratch. When we were getting ready for, say, an election night coverage, even at that time, WBRU had probably the biggest election coverage team in our listening area. Just, of course, if you have a lot of people who you want to be able to put on the air from various places, you needed a lot of equipment and things. And we would just, building little amplifiers and things for little mini remote studios.
Penny Dixon Gump wasn't the only Pembroker involved in WBRU during this era, but the station remained male-dominated. Brown University Professor of American Civilization Susan Smolian.
If you work for a radio station, you're supposed to have some kind of technical knowledge. And I think women have always had those interests, but have not had a chance to express them often.
It was unusual to have women interested in broadcasting at the time.
Don Burns.
I think there was a definite early sexist quality to radio. And a lot of women, and this was true for many years, had voices that were... they weren't pleasant to listen to. I don't know why. I don't know why that is, and I think over the years that's changed completely, and maybe because there became a lot of good women to listen to and emulate. But at the time, there weren't very many.
by the time rock and roll came along, there would always be a spot for a woman disc jockey on a freeform rock station. Not two spots, probably, but one spot. And so that, I think, is when things started to change a bit.
With just a few years under their belts, students at WBRU got even more ambitious. Lawrence Moss secured a bank loan to pay for a stronger signal. WBRU-FM already owned one of the most powerful FM transmitters in the country, but in 1971, WBRU-FM more than doubled its power to an incredible 50,000 watts. The Brown University Science Library Tower, also known as the Mile High Biosci Lie, the highest point in Rhode Island, seemed like an optimal location.
Well, you know, we went about it very professionally. We hired consultants and engineers who, you know, studied the situation, told us that the Sciences Tower was a good place to put it, you know, told us, you know, the signal was directional and it wouldn't go down and it wouldn't hurt experiments.
But when Brown University scientists experimented with reading monkeys' brainwaves, they found that even their primate friends were tuned into Southern New England's number one rock station. The signal created interference problems on campus for the next several years until it voluntarily returned to its 20,000-watt signal a few years later. In 1970, a program was born that's part of BRU's programming to this day. The 360-degree Black experience in sound.
As freeform DJs experimented with segues from one style of music to the next, WBRU was one of the only stations in Rhode Island airing new African-American music outside of the mainstream. Vincent Thomas, class of 73, came to Brown in 1969 from Washington, D.C., where he had worked to increase minority involvement in the media.
Coming to Providence, Rhode Island at the time, the only African-American music of any kind of variety that you could hear in Providence, Rhode Island was a gentleman named the Little Groove Maker who came on WICE AM on Sundays from 9 to 10 p.m. That wasn't going to work. So, you know, I started going over to WBRU. Okay, now as I'm trying to get on the air, you know, I'm coming in with the traditional, you know, format thinking. Do I do a jazz show? Do I do a blues show? Do I do a soul music show? Or do I do all three?
Trying to make it real. But compared to what?
Program director Roger Norton and others within the music department supported the idea of a show that focused on African American music, but some felt that these styles should be incorporated into regular free-form rock programming.
At the time that I was jockeying to do this all-black music programming in 1970, WBRU's program director was African-American, a gentleman named Roger Norton. So it was the irony of, you know, how can you do this at BRU? You know, this is what we do. We can't, you know, do the segregated programming, you know, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Because what happened at the end of the day, everybody bought into the idea because basically I was doing BRU's kind of like eclectic across the board. How do we go from musical styles? I just, you know, just kind of kept it in the framework of African-American music.
Vincent Thomas first aired the show on the Sunday of a Thanksgiving break in 1970, but he refined his programming vision after a summer internship at Howard University's radio station, where the slogan was 360 Degrees of Black Experience. WHUR became a news hub for the civil rights movement at a time when most minority stations were broadcasting a narrow selection of soul music. The idea of a 360 experience resonated with Thomas, but for the first few years of the show, he called it Music for the People.
In other news, Hartford, Connecticut police have seized about $500,000 worth of heroin in what one police official called one of the largest single drug hauls in city history. Two persons were arrested in the raid staged by a dozen detectives yesterday that also netted thousands of dollars worth of stolen goods, including TV sets, typewriters, tape decks, and adding machines. This is Vincent Thomas for WBRU News.
Take what I have to say for all the good it's worth.
So obviously when I went on the air, all the African-American students on campus just had to stay, you know, had the speakers blasting out the windows, everything else, because, you know, obviously that they weren't hearing anything like this. And then the other thing is that it resonated in the communities of color in Providence.
As the only outlet of this kind in Rhode Island, 360 became a forum for discussion of issues relevant to Providence's minority communities.
Well, example that I think of as foremost is there were incidents of police brutality.
Skip Barlow, class of 77, became a 360 programmer.
Any incident such as that would flare up the entire community. And I remember one real serious incident where shot a black youth, and it was a big issue for months in the community of Providence. And so WBRU dealt with that issue. I mean, they spent a whole show just taking phone calls because that's what everybody was talking about. So it wasn't just about music, even though music was the main focus.
In 1977, 360 was at the center of a divisive battle at WBRU. Thomas Hart, one of the students most actively involved in 360, contacted the National Black Media Coalition and threatened to file a petition to deny the renewal of WBRU's license.
I learned in 75 and 76 that it's not a right but a privilege to operate a radio station in America, and you have to renew that right and privilege by making a showing that your programming and your service is consistent with the public interest.
Hart argued that the station needed more than 4 hours of minority programming a week. He felt that blacks deserved at least 10% of the programming and more opportunities to be in management and on the air.
WBRU FM, Providence.
Eric Schultz, class of 79, remembers it this way.
They decided to go after our tax exempt status. They had written out their position, what their plans were to appeal to the IRS in a letter and on BRU stationery or on a BRU envelope, and someone had left it in a rental car, I believe in Washington, D.C. The rental agency saw it and sent it to us, and all of a sudden we're sitting there with this letter from Project Juggler, which is designed to take the tax exempt, to challenge the tax exempt status of the station.
Peter Tannenwald, class of 64, and also the station's FCC lawyer, handled the claim.
So the chairman of the National Black Media Coalition comes up here. I come up here and we have a big meeting, and there's a lot of pounding on the table where he accused WBRU of burying its public affairs programming at 6 in the morning, as did most radio stations, just to meet FCC requirements. He said it's an outrage. And I looked at him and I said, I don't understand. It's at 6 in the evening, and the meeting pretty well ended there, and we didn't have any big problem after that.
When Peter Tannenwald and student managers finally came to an agreement, both 360 and Jazz expanded their programming hours. Despite fits and starts, in its first decade, WBRU-FM found that experimentation and financial stability could go hand in hand as they strove for success on their own terms. WBRU came of age in this revolutionary decade of American history and carved an identity for itself beyond Brown University.
A lot of people in the faculty were very critical of the station. Commercial station, why should the university? They thought subsidized broadcasting with so little redeeming social value. They're playing that awful music, not the classical music I like. Of course, they were wrong about the subsidy. There had been a subsidy, but that became a surplus.
Even as the station looked towards the progressive future, it hadn't lost sight of its past.
At that point, we still had around the very earliest founders of the station, George Abraham. I think he lived in Washington with a llama in his backyard or something.
WBRU caught on to the music and values of a new generation before any other station in Providence. Meanwhile, more and more stations around the country started finding success with a similar attitude.
And at the time, we didn't know it, but we were, you know, paving the way for people to listen to FM. But I believe that we felt we were part of a small and growing but important community that was by and spoke to people of a certain era, of a certain age.